Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, power is shifting, spreading, and changing hands more rapidly than ever before. What does that mean for global politics, religion, and economies? Then, we'll look inside the prison and the politics of Guantanamo Bay. Our next guest says that power is decaying in nearly every aspect of life, in conflicts, governance, business, and religion. Why is it changing so fast? And what are the consequences, good and bad? Moises Naim is a scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and an internationally syndicated columnist. His book is called The End of Power, From Boardrooms to Battlefields and Churches to States, Why Being in Charge Isn't What It Used to Be. Welcome. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Maria. Delighted to be with you.
Let's start with a definition of power. What is power?
It's the ability of one party, one person, one country to get another to do or stop doing something. And of course, it can get far more complicated than that. And experts have developed highly complex and sophisticated definitions of power. But for our purposes, this is more than enough.
Would persuasion fall into that?
There are two ways of dealing with this. One is changing the structure of a situation. So if you are and I are negotiating the price of a house that I'm selling, if I have the power of changing the structure of the situation, meaning I will lower the price, then I have the ability to make you do something, which is buy the house because I have changed the incentives. But I can do something else. I can explain how good the high schools and schools are around the house, and there I will change the perception you have of the situation, and I am persuading you of doing what I want you to do by changing. No, I haven't changed the structure of the situation. I have shown you a different way of looking at it.
Let's talk about what these four channels of power are.
Well, there are several. One is, of course, the muscle, which is essentially the coercion. The muscle is, of course, the one that is better known, is the most obvious, is the threat of force, is the blunt instrument through which power is exercised in extreme situations. The muscle can take the form of a conquering army, a police force, which handcuffs and jails, sells a bully in a schoolyard, a knife on the neck, etc. It's the sheer force. Then is the code. The code is essentially the morals, traditional, cultural mores, social expectations, the religious beliefs and values handed down through generations or taught to children in school. And it's very, very powerful in terms of that tradition. It tends to be a very, very important source of behavior. Then there's a pitch, is the ability that power of advertising, for example, is persuasing, is showing advantages or benefits or reasons to do or stop doing something. And then there is the reward. The reward is just providing material incentives. Compensation schemes, these all kinds of inducements, material inducements to get someone to do or stop doing something.
And then you've talked also about the scope and constraints on power. What are those and how have they changed?
The essential argument of the book is that those who have power retain it because they have something special, a special asset that shields them from the challenges of others that want that power. That special something can be a technology, or it can be a brand name, or it can be millions of followers or voters, or it can be wealth or a mighty army. And those shields protect the powerful and allow them to continue to be powerful. And my point is that those shields are becoming less protective. There are many sources for this. Of course, when one says that, the initial instinct is to say, well, of course, it's the Internet. It's social media. It's Twitter and Facebook and Google and all of the tools that spread information and disintermediate and create opportunities for newcomers. And, of course, that's one important aspect. But I claim in the book that that's not the main one, because technology at the end is a tool, and a tool needs users. And users have incentives and direction and motivations. And so we need to look at the structure of incentives that creates the direction in which these users of technology move, and the motivations, really, that they have. And these are changing as a result of tectonic shifts in the world that include but transcend technology, and especially the Internet. I'm talking about demographic shifts, changes in the way in which humanity is distributed around the world, the size of the population, the way they move, the way they behave. And so I grouped these many, many factors into three categories that I call the three revolutions: the more, the mobility, and the mentality revolutions.
In fact, you said that it was these rather than the internet itself that enabled the Arab revolutions to happen.
Exactly. If you think, for example, about where it all started in the Arab revolutions, it started in Tunisia. Tunisia is one of the most successful North African countries. It had the highest growth rate in that region. It is a country that was not divided as deeply as others in terms of religious or sectarian conflicts. It was well integrated into Europe. It had high educational levels and in a very fast-growing middle class. And there is where it started. So that tells us something, and that something is that Tunisia was at the center of what I call the three revolutions. It had a lot of expansion. It had more population. It was younger. It was well-educated. What they didn't have was jobs, and it was a very difficult situation in that respect. But that population was not only that it had more of everything. There were more people, but they were more educated. They were more affluent in many ways, and they moved. And that, and the moving, the mobility revolution, in which it is a world in which everything moves more. People, but also goods, services, information, technology, ideology, financial crisis, pandemics, everything moves more. And together, they change the way we think and the way we hope, the way we believe, the way our values change. And that is the mentality, their revolution. So all of these three forces were very, very visible in Tunisia.
What it really is what was behind the social media, and the social media was merely a tool, one of a few, that enabled these things to be communicated.
Exactly. And then you could see how it spread and how it all started in this small town in the interior of Tunisia, and that then became a revolution in Tunisia and then rapidly spread to Libya and to Yemen and to Egypt and now Syria. And you can find in a lot of places around the world these forces at work.
Let's look at your other fundamental premise. Why did you choose the word decay, that power is decaying, rather than that it's really becoming more elusive and more diffuse? Is it really decaying?
Yes, because you can get diffusion without really losing its effectiveness. What I argue in the book is that power has become easier to get, but much harder to use and easier to lose. It is becoming more fleeting. So not just diffusing. Diffusing means, for example, that power is shifting from Europe and the United States towards Asia, which, of course, is happening, as we know. But that's not the entire story. That has been the dominant narrative until now. But it's more than that is happening. And what is happening is that when power shifts to Asia, those in Asia that acquire a decayed power, a power that yields less benefits, a power that they can do less with. So those that have power now or have acquired power are more limited in what they can do with it, and they are less secure in their holding of that power, and that power, in fact, is more fleeting. That together is why I say that it's decaying and not merely shifting.
And so if you were going to look for evidence of this argument, what would be some of the key places that you would look?
And the book has different chapters on different arenas of human activity. And in all of them, I claim, these trends are visible. They're visible in the world of armed conflict and the military, but also in the religion and churches, in national politics or international politics. You can also see it in the power of labor unions and in the power of religions.
Let's look at some of these and look at the evidence for each of them. Let's start with conflict.
There's a fascinating study by a Harvard scholar called Ivan Arrigin. he decided to look at armed conflict between two sides in which you could measure the relative strength by the traditional metrics that are used by experts on military conflicts. And so he identified those conflicts between 1850 to 1949. And he discovered that in that period, the weak side, the side that objectively had less military power, won 12% of the time. Then he extended that study from 1950 to 1998, and he discovered that the side that was weaker won 55% of the time. That meant that in modern times, in contemporary times, the weak side had more probability to win than the quote-unquote strong part of the conflict, which is quite significant and in fact is a statistical corroboration of something that we're seeing around us, and that is the theme of asymmetric wars. We have seen, for example, how the United States lately has had a hard time winning wars, and mostly what is confronting is new kinds of combatants, insurgents and guerrillas, and all kinds of groups that sometimes they don't win, but they surely deny victory to this mightiest military force ever assembled. We can see it in the Taliban in Afghanistan and Pakistan. We can see it with the pirates that ply the seas in front of the Gulf of Aden. These people are former fishermen that take out their rickety boats in outboard motor with outboard motors and AK-47, their rifle, the assault rifle, and they are able to hijack and for ransom some of the biggest ships in the world, big tankers and big cargo ships, even passenger ships. And the world has reacted by deploying in those waters one of the most sophisticated flotilla of vessels armed with the latest technologies. And everyone is there. NATO is there, and Ukraine, and Japan, and China. Everyone is patrolling those waters trying to protect the commercial routes. And yet the pirates continue to be able to hijack these very, very big ships. Again, they are not going to win over this mighty force, but they're denying the world powers the ability to ensure a secure travel of their commercial ships. And we see, for example, you know, that of course, the now very well known, the tragically known example of Al-Qaeda. Staging 9/11 cost something about $500,000. But it inflicted damages that are now measured in the trillions of dollars. So this is the kind of new forms of armed conflict that are transforming the nature of the military and are showing that size, for example, or investment and technology no longer guarantee national security and no longer guarantee that you will win over your enemies, even if they are smaller or not that well armed, or not as well equipped and trained as the largest armies.
This is the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Moises Naim about his new book, The End of Power. What about in corporate America and multinational corporations? You say they're also losing power.
Yes, and again, there is statistics that support that view. There's another very interesting study. They looked at the probability that a company that got to the top 20% of its industry would stay there in the following 5 years. In the 1980s, the probability of falling out of that category was only 10%. That meant that if you made it to the top, you were more or less secure. You could relax because you would stay there. 90% probability that 5 years hence, you would still be in the top 20%. But then 2 decades later, the turnover rate doubled. And companies that were at the top, they were no longer that secure. The changes and the challengers were more able to dislodge their well-established behemoths. And that became very slippery at the top, not just for companies, but also for the CEOs. Those very powerful CEOs that are so well paid, sometimes obscenely paid, and are very, undoubtedly, they are very powerful, are being fired at unprecedented rates. Average tenure of a CEO, the top of a company, has essentially declined precipitously in recent years. So there's another interesting study that shows the consequences of reputational accidents. In the 1990s, the probability of a company suffering mightily because of a reputational blunder or a blunder that would affect its reputation was about 20%. Nowadays, it's 82%, which means that a company has almost certainty that something will happen, that it will damage its brand, its reputation, and so on. These companies that came out on top after the financial crisis, and everyone thought that five financial groups that concentrated so many assets with their CEOs at the helm, that were these masters of the universe, will continue to drive and shape the financial sector. Several of them have been fired and others are under attack. JP Morgan has been accused and regulators are on their back. Another bank, HSBC, is also under pressure. Barclays is also accused of misdeeds in rigging interest rates.
Do you think it's because of the diffusion of power necessarily, or do you think it's because they're acting so much more unethically that finally they're getting a few slaps on the wrist? And we might add, we haven't seen anybody go to prison.
Well, that's not really true. We have seen many go to prison. The story here is less of criminal behavior and more of an industry that was capable of conducting business in a way that did not was objectionable and was contrary to the interest of society. But mostly, Maria, what I would say is that we have no evidence that today companies behave in more corrupt ways than in the past. Except that now we know more. There are lots of behaviors that in the past were taken for granted that are now better scrutinized. We have more information. We have the risk of misbehaving, I think, now is evidently more profound, more important. And again, one should not underestimate the power of competition. There is no doubt that there is far more competition now, and companies are constantly being dislodged by new rivals.
And you also point out that governments themselves are being challenged, particularly when they're authoritarian, and that this is part of the decay of power.
Yes, and the numbers there are also quite staggering. The number of authoritarian regimes in the world has declined quite significantly. The electoral democracies in 1990 were just 69. Today is 117. So the number of tyrants, the number of authoritarian governments in the world has declined quite significantly. But it also happening in democracies. If you look at the margins of victory, of electoral victory in democracies around the world, you will discover that they have been shrinking. So in places where elections are free and fair and valid, candidates that win no longer win with the same levels of support and the margins of victory over their rivals as they used in the past. Landslide victories are becoming endangered species. And that means that these governments don't have very strong mandates, that voters don't seem to like to give very strong mandates and power to government. They seem to prefer divided governments, meaning electing a chief executive, a president, or a head of state, a prime minister, but then immediately also voting for a parliament or a congress or a national assembly that is controlled by the opposition. In 30 out of 34 of the largest democracies in the world, this is what's happening. And in many of them, you end up having very unwieldy coalitions and very strange bedfellows, political bedfellows that have to agree and have to find compromises and have these unstable and very often not very functional political arrangements that generate gridlock, that generate situations in which decisions are taken not that effectively, that are delayed, and that effectively do not solve the problems that are in front of them.
Let's talk about the upside and the downside. Some of the upsides, of course, more democracy, more options, power actually being spread out a little bit more. Perhaps it's good that nobody has absolute power, absolutely, but you say there's also all these downsides. Let's go through some of those.
Yes, and again, I just want to echo that I am celebrating many of the trends that I describe in the book. There's much to welcome for us as citizens, as voters, as consumers, as people that want to come up with a new way of challenging established companies. So there's a lot to celebrate, and it's a world that has more opportunity for everyone, and it's a world that is not as good if you're a monopolist or if you are an authoritarian government. But then there are some downsides, as you mentioned, and one of the downsides is especially notable in the realm of domestic politics, in which in a lot of countries you see the head of state being like Gulliver, tied down by all kinds of Lilliputians, governments that are unable to act either because they are constrained by the legislative in ways that are quite strong, or governments that are limited because the extent of devolution of power from the national capital to state and local governments, or because activist judges are limiting what they can do, or independent central banks are also imposing constraints in their economic policies, or all kinds of non-governmental organizations that also interfere, shape government policies, lobbyists, and all kinds of international forces. So we see national governments that are becoming more and more hobbled giants, incapable of acting effectively and timely to deal with the society's problems. And that is one of the downsides. And Frank Fukuyama, a political scientist, has coined a term, vetocracy, which is these democracies are becoming vetocracies, meaning they are full of centers of veto power. No one has enough power to push through an agenda or a vision or a program, but everyone seems to have just enough power to block what everybody else is doing. And that is how you end with stalemate, with gridlock, and with urgent decisions not being tackled effectively.
The other thing I thought was kind of an amusing word that you used was slacktivism that was coming about as a result of the diffusion of the power, that people are active politically in a slacker sort of a way. What is that?
That is the notion that you feel good because you go to a website and you sign a petition and you feel that you have done your share of political participation, or you have given through the internet a few dollars for a cause or for an emergency. So the internet is also very good at generating and energizing and recruiting people for politics, but it also provides this false sense of participation. That means that just say like in a Facebook, send a tweet in support of something, and you feel that you're participating. And of course, that's better than nothing, but surely far short of what's needed.
If you were going to say the most important things that people need to know or how to deal with the changes in power, what would you say that is?
First, know that power is becoming very fleeting, and therefore do not behave as power is permanent or you have it forever or for a long time, and be aware that you have great limits in what you can do with it. Second, try to develop your peripheral vision, meaning your competitor and people or institutions that are going to challenge you are going to come from very improbable, surprising places. They're not going to be your traditional rivals. They may be coming from all kinds of places, both different industries or different regions or different demographies. Third is that tradition may no longer buy as much as it did in the past. And the notion, that famous phrase, this is done this way because it has always been done this way, is more and more ineffective and unaccepted by everyone. And the power of tradition is declining. And finally, beware of size as the main source of power. Size no longer ensures that power is there to stay or that power is enough.
Moises Naim is a scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and an internationally syndicated columnist. The book is called The End of Power, From Boardrooms to Battlefields and Churches to States, Why Being in Charge Isn't What It Used to Be. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Maria.
When we come back, Inside the Prison and the Politics of Guantanamo Bay, stay tuned. We'll be right back. is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. What is going on with Guantanamo Bay Detention Center? Who is left in detention? Why are they still there? What are the legal and diplomatic ramifications? And what are the politics that are preventing the facility's closure? We have three experts with us. David Glazier is fellow and professor of law at Loyola Law School. He's the author of numerous publications, including A Self-Inflicted Wound, A Half Dozen Years of Turmoil Over the Guantanamo Military Commissions, and Full and Fair by What Measure, International Law Applicable to the Military Commission Process. Jonathan Hafetz is with us. He is professor of law at Seton Hall. He is the author of Habeas Corpus After 9/11, Confronting America's New Global Detention System, and the co-editor with Mark Denbo of The Guantanamo Lawyers, Inside a Prison, Outside the Law. Peter Jan Honigsberg is professor of law at University of San Francisco School of Law. He's the founder and director of the Witness to Guantanamo Project. He's also the author of numerous publications, including the book Our Nation Unhinged, The Human Consequences of the War on Terror, and law publications Chasing Enemy Combatants and Circumventing International Law, A License for Sanctioned Abuse. Welcome to the three of you. I'd like to start with how Guantanamo Bay Prison came about in the first place, and also how it's situated in American history and law. Jonathan Hafetz, let's start with you. What happened and how did we get to this?
It's a long story by now. Guantanamo Bay Prison opened in January of 2002 when the Bush administration began bringing individuals there, largely, although certainly not exclusively, people who had been picked up during the conflict in Afghanistan. And they were brought there for really two purposes. The first purpose was for interrogation purposes, and the second related purpose was for detention. And what made Guantanamo so controversial right off the bat was that the United States was attempting to create a prison outside the law. It deliberately brought them to Guantanamo, chose Guantanamo as a place because it's a military base or naval base where the U.S. had total control over approximately a 40-mile square territory, but it also belonged to Cuba, technically still belonged to Cuba under the terms of a lease that dates back over a century. And so you had this U.S. enclave where the U.S. had free reign of the place, but it was outside the United States, formally speaking, for legal purposes. And so the rationale behind that was to deny the detainees access to the court system. Plus, you had a new theory that was being pressed in the Bush administration was to label these prisoners enemy combatants. And by that, they were distinct from fighters in other armed conflicts in that they had no legal rights. They were deemed to be outside of the Geneva Conventions, so they had no protections against wrongful detention, in particular no protections against abusive treatment under the law. So it was to create a prison outside the law to hold individuals who were deemed to be themselves outside the law and outside of all legal protections.
Peter Jan Honigsberg, let's bring you in. Do you know of any historic precedent for something quite like this? How does it fit within American history, American law?
I would say the term enemy combatant was a newly derived term by the Bush administration. That kind of term never existed before. Americans followed the Geneva Conventions up until then, and that was, as Jonathan expressed, completely outside the law. They circumvented the Geneva Conventions, deliberately did so that people would not have any legal process. Rule of law was abandoned, essentially, and America had different issues over the 200 years where, like when Lincoln suspended habeas on his own, which he couldn't do, and of course people were concerned about that, but this is the first time that the U.S. went so far as to just grab a number of people and just determine that they had no rights at all outside international or American law.
David Glazier, how does it compare with the historic use of military commissions?
It's a departure in that respect also. What few people seem to really know is that the military commission was actually invented to try American service personnel. When the United States Army marched into Mexico during the Mexican War, it found it had no legal authority to try American servicemen for regular common crimes that they committed. Military law of that day only defined service-connected crimes, such as desertion, disobedience of orders, things like that. And so the military commission was created to employ sort of a common law of war and try Americans, and later did try some Mexicans. But throughout their early history, the military commissions were intended to do justice at the same level of the court-martial and even-handedly tried Americans and foreigners. So the Bush administration use of a military commission, which it knows is substandard and therefore has limited to only trying foreigners, is unprecedented. We've never tried to have a separate inferior tribunal for foreigners on the premise that somehow a lesser standard of justice is just fine for them because they're not Americans.
Now, was there an effort, I'm trying to remember back into World War II, that was struck down by the Supreme Court?
The military commissions have been challenged in the court several times, including several cases in the World War II era. The most famous case was called Ex parte Kieran, which reviewed the Roosevelt administration's efforts to try 8 Nazi saboteurs in Washington, D.C. in 1942. But one of the saboteurs was, at least one, was a known American citizen. Another one had a claim to American citizenship, and the Supreme Court specifically upheld their trial. So while the military commission had its faults, one thing it didn't do was try to discriminate or provide a lower standard of justice to foreigners.
Well, let's now move to who actually has been in Guantanamo, who is still there. Peter Honigsberg, who are the detainees, both those who have been detained and those who are still detained?
People believe that Cheney was the person who thought of just casting a wide net and grabbing anyone who was in Afghanistan at the time, and as Johnson said, in some other countries as well, and bringing them to Guantanamo to send a message to the world that we are powerful and that we won't accept what happened. And apparently it was also true that Bush and Cheney knew that many of the people they were bringing to Guantanamo were not a danger and perhaps totally, quote, innocent, but it didn't matter. There was a message that was being sent out. And your listeners probably know that millions of leaflets and flyers were dropped over Afghanistan offering ransom to anybody who brought one of these al-Qaeda or Taliban people, as the locals thought, and sold them to Americans for somewhat around $3,000, sometimes more. And apparently tribal Afghanis would sell enemies of theirs, as well as any Arab that happened to be in the community, they would grab and sell as well. Musharraf, in his book, claimed that he made about $6 million selling these people to Americans. So Americans didn't capture these people at all. They were basically purchased by us. And that's how they came to Guantanamo.
So in some ways, there could be a lot of doubt cast upon who were detained because of the money-making element.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there were that's certainly true.
Jonathan Hafetz?
I would certainly concur about the dragnet nature of who was brought to Guantanamo. At the very beginning, until 2006, when 14 so-called high-value detainees were transferred there from secret CIA prisons, there were really very, very few at Guantanamo who were really accused of any terrorist act itself. Now, in terms of who's there now, the way basically the administration has been divided up the population, you have approximately half, or in fact, slightly more than half of the current 166 detainees are people who the government has, or the Obama administration has cleared for release, and yet they've remained there. They've been cleared for release for about 3 years. About 50 or so of those individuals are from Yemen, but there's been a ban that was imposed by the president after the Christmas 2009 attempted underwear bombing of transferring any prisoners to Yemen. And then you have, of the remaining 80 or so, they're divided into two categories. One is individuals who the administration would like to prosecute in either a federal court or a military commission, but given restrictions imposed by Congress, they've essentially barred any federal court prosecutions. So any of those prosecutions would have to go forward in commissions, which are problematic for a host of reasons. The other category is a group of individuals who the administration has said are too difficult to try, too dangerous to release, and they're being held in so-called law of war detention, which I think is problematic, particularly as we're so many years out from when they were originally picked up. And those individuals are simply being held for the duration of the conflict, and the way that the conflict has been defined, which I think is one of the most important aspects of Guantanamo, it's been defined as a global armed conflict against al-Qaeda and associated forces that's not limited to any territory. And I think this issue is going to really come to a head in 2014 when the United States withdraws from Afghanistan.
Now, I understand there are some detainees like the Uyghurs who have very unique circumstances. Peter, what can you tell us about these particular detainees?
The Uyghurs, even though they're, quote, from China, they're from East Turkestan, which is overrun by the Chinese in the last century, and so they don't consider themselves Chinese, and in fact, often are in armed struggle with the Chinese in what they feel is their own territory in East Turkestan. That's why the Chinese consider the Uyghurs terrorists as well. They were picked up by the U.S. They were purchased also, but the U.S. realized very quickly that, in fact, none of them was, quote, a terrorist, at least not toward the U.S., but China believed that they were terrorists to China, and China put a lot of pressure on the U.S. to keep them and not release them. In fact, China put pressure on countries not to accept them if we did release them. Over time, the U.S. was able to release some of them to Albania, then to Palau and Bermuda, and then a couple went to El Salvador. But China's been putting so much pressure on the countries that most countries won't accept them. And three Uyghurs are still in Guantanamo. They could have gone to Palau. They chose not to. They thought Palau was just the end of the earth for them, and they chose not to, and they're still in Guantanamo. Essentially, the U.S. tried to, at one point, bring a few Uyghurs into the U.S. The Obama administration had the authority and the power to bring several Uyghurs into the U.S. These are Uyghurs who ended up in Bermuda, and that was blocked by Congress because Obama took too long in moving, and he was afraid of taking on Congress on that issue, and so the Uyghurs didn't come to America. Had they come, I think the whole world would have appreciated that Obama really did care about the detainees and that, in fact, was trying to close Guantanamo. But once that was shut down and Obama didn't really fight that, things just fell apart, and that's why you still have Guantanamo open.
I wanted to learn about your project, WitnessToGuantanamo.com, and what you're learning from that. Now, in this project, you've been videotaping people who've been there, whether they were former detainees or guards or other personnel. If you had a takeaway from the knowledge you've gained from this, what would you say that is?
The takeaway for the Witness to Guantanamo project is one word can best express it to your listeners, and that word is humanity. Anybody who gets online and sees any of the clips from our interviews will feel is that what we've found is that no matter who we interviewed, we're all part of the same world. And you get a real sense that the people who Americans don't know, the people who were captured and were brought to Guantanamo, are just like us. I can tell you a wonderful story of a father whose son is still in Guantanamo, and we interviewed him in Kuwait, and we asked him how his wife was handling the fact that his son had been there now for 10 years. And he told us that sometimes the father will wake up in the middle of the night and his wife is not in bed with him, and he used to wonder where his wife went. And then he realized that his wife went into their son's room and slept in their son's bed. And I think that's exactly what the world needs to know, that no matter who we interviewed, and like you described, we've interviewed Americans, prison guards and chaplains and interrogators and military officials and FBI officials and CIA officials. And, of course, all the detainees were all together in as one part of humanity.
There was one particular story I thought was very striking about a detainee and one of the guards actually becoming friends.
That's right. One of the guards, who surprisingly is a Houston cop, and he one day while he was living in Houston, he just got on Facebook and he started to type in the names of some of the men from England who he had guarded, who he spoke to because they had common language. And sure enough, their names popped up in Facebook. And he couldn't believe it, and so he emailed them through Facebook, and they responded. And pretty soon they became friends, and they exchanged family photos. And then he went to England to visit with these men that he used to guard. So there's some very heartwarming stories on how people have changed and transformed through their experiences in Guantanamo.
You're listening to The Scholar's Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the legal and political issues around Guantanamo Bay. I'd like to turn to the politics of this. And as I understand it, President Obama had made an early effort to close Guantanamo Bay. It was a promise he had made during the campaign for president. Congress blocked it at the time, but then there was a whole series of things occurred. David Glaser, what do we need to know about the politics to understand what's going on today?
I think we have to be careful not to give the Obama administration a free pass. When the president was elected, there were no restraints on what he could do at the time, but he lacked the will. I mean, he announced immediately that he was going to close Guantanamo, but then seems to me lacked the political will to actually make it happen. And instead, he put together groups to study it and, you know, just proceeded very, very cautiously. Also, to my great disappointment, relied an awful lot on the same people who'd been advising the Bush administration. You know, he didn't make a clean sweep of the leadership in the Department of Defense, for example, and the people that were working these issues. And so an awful lot of the same people who had been advising the Bush administration advised the Obama administration. And by the time he might have actually done something, you know, it gave Congress plenty of time to think about this and to start imposing restrictions on transfers. And now the administration is conveniently trying to put the blame on Congress, pointing at these restrictions. But the fact is that they had plenty of time early in the first administration to do something. I think we have to go back to the point that Peter and Jonathan made when we first started talking about who's there now. We have to be very clear. Fully one half of the people at Guantanamo have been determined by the United States government more than 3 years ago to pose no threat to the United States. And there is, therefore, no law in the world that allows us to hold these individuals. We're in violation of the law of war. We're in violation of international human rights law. There's nothing in the U.S. Constitution that allows the United States to unilaterally detain people just because we want to. This is, frankly, one of the more egregious things that our government has done. And I'm actually a very centrist on this. I mean, I do believe that there is a limited authority under the law of war for preventive detention of people who are an actual threat. But the fact that we're holding more than 80 men at Guantanamo, who we have acknowledged for years pose no threat at all, is one of the most shameful things that this country has ever done.
Now, how do we explain it? How does the administration explain it?
Well, I think the administration needs to have some courage and needs to tell the American people that we're doing what we need to do and what the law permits to protect the American people.
What I'm asking is, how are they justifying this?
They're not. Simply, nobody's calling them on it, and they're not having to justify it. And when, you know, the critics of the administration want to err on the side of holding people, I mean, we had a couple senators just in the past couple of weeks who wanted the United States to subject a kid in Boston who's a lone wolf terrorist, or he and his brother are freelancers. They have no ties to any military organization anywhere. And we have United States senators who are criticizing the president for not putting those folks in military detention. There's no legal basis whatsoever for military detention. You know, from a legal perspective, it's a joke to suggest that they could be held in military detention. And yet when you have senators that are getting away with telling the American public that kind of thing because nobody's willing to call them on it, it creates this climate in which the administration is not having to justify anything it's doing. It's only having to justify itself when it tries to do something that's perceived as humanitarian, which is crazy. So we're completely giving the administration a free pass in terms of violating the law.
Jonathan Huffetz.
I fully agree with Davis. The administration, I think, made, you know, two critical errors during the period of time, its first term, where they could have actually taken steps. One, as Peter mentioned before, they did not take action to bring detainees who they had cleared for release to the United States, the Uyghurs, who the U.S. government admitted, you know, recognized, posed no threat, had been detained at Guantanamo for years. And they allowed a backlash to build. They gave in to, you know, fears about the politics of the situation. And so with that, that was a key step in terms of allowing the backlash to build and also in chilling efforts to try to resettle Guantanamo detainees elsewhere. I think the second big mistake they made was not following through on the pledge to bring Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged 9/11 mastermind, his co-conspirators, again, one of the handful of Guantanamo detainees that were actually accused of a terrorist attack, to bring them to the United States federal court for prosecution. Instead, Attorney General Holder said that's what the administration wanted to do, but they didn't lay the groundwork enough locally. And once there was a backlash against bringing, you know, terrorists to the United States to try them, they didn't take action to defeat it, and they just essentially caved in, which I think, you know, made clear that anytime Lindsey Graham or John McCain would politic around the Obama administration being weak and trying to do anything on Guantanamo, what that showed is that the Obama administration would cave in. So instead, they're going ahead and trying what's probably the biggest terrorism case in the history of the United States, the people responsible for the 9/11 attacks, in a military commission, which has proven, despite multiple efforts to bring reforms, it's just not reformable. No matter what they try to do on paper, in practice, it's just proven itself to be a second-class justice system. And the only thing that I think is encouraging at all is it's clear that the wheels are coming off the bus, and the system is not going to be able to produce a valid trial. But I think between these two mistakes early on, the Obama administration gave in and showed it was not going to expend any political capital to realize kind of the broad, rule of law agenda that the president set forth following his inauguration.
Before we move on from you, Jonathan Hafetz, I wanted to ask you about another thing that you have studied that deals with the lawyers for the Guantanamo prisoners. I understand they've had to deal with a lot of very unique circumstances. What were they?
There's so many circumstances. I mean, to start with the beginning, the fact that the lawyers did not have access to their clients for more than 2 years, for the first 2+ years of Guantanamo until the first Supreme Court decision in 2004 recognizing the right to habeas corpus. The lawyers could not visit. They could not see their clients. They were being held in secret, well, not secret, but incommunicado detention. But even after there was a right counsel that was won, there have been tremendous restrictions that have been put on lawyers. To begin with, even going down to see a client at Guantanamo is very difficult. You've got to make difficult travel arrangements. You've got to get a special security clearance, which takes months. And then, to go down, it's very, very difficult to just get down to the prison and to see the client. So access just logistically is difficult. But that's not the only thing. What the government has abused its classification authority by essentially saying that anything that a detainee tells his or her lawyer is presumptively classified, and so that the lawyers then have to present that information to a Department of Justice review team in order to be able to talk about it publicly or to put it into court papers. So that's a major obstacle, and it's also increased the amount of secrecy that surrounds the Guantanamo prison. I mean, there are so many different things that have happened over the years, including deliberate attempts by the U.S. government, really under the Bush administration, also to create mistrust between lawyers and their clients, try to fear the attorney-client relationship. It's been very, very difficult for attorneys to carry out their jobs and to represent the clients. And that's something that I think still continues today. It's something we see in various aspects of the system.
Would you say that the prosecution of the lawyer Lynn Stewart would fall into this category?
No, that's different. I think that there are certainly issues surrounding that. You had something there that I think was different than an allegation that the lawyer was attempting to get information from, pass information from the client on to aid in that client's activities, terrorist activities. There's never been any allegation made against any Guantanamo lawyer like that. But the only allegations have been, there's been no allegation like that at all. I think the Lynn Stewart situation is very different, and the government has tried to use its authority and its control over the prison to really limit the lawyers from being able to do their job in terms of communicating with their clients and communicating what their clients tell them to the outside world.
You're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the legal and political issues around Guantanamo Bay. Let's move to the international context, the effect on diplomacy, on law itself. Peter, let's bring you back in. What do you think these effects have been as a result of what's gone on with Guantanamo?
It's been very clear that initially when President Obama said he was going to close Guantanamo, many countries agreed to accept the detainees from Guantanamo as a goodwill gesture toward Obama. They believed that Obama really did intend to close it, and they offered their services. And in fact, the reason why most of these countries did accept is because of that. I spoke to someone who was very involved in the State Department in finding homes for the detainees, and that's essentially the goodwill that worked. Even some countries that opposed our policies and were actually quite critical agreed to accept some of the men as a goodwill gesture to help close the base. So the world really did care at the beginning when Obama first said he was going to close Guantanamo. Subsequently, as it became apparent that Obama was not going to close Guantanamo, the countries shut down and would no longer accept prisoners. They felt that it was no longer worth it for them. And what's really interesting, is that almost all the media that I get, you're unusual. Most of the media who contacts me are from the world outside the U.S. Very few people in the U.S. seem to care about Guantanamo. In fact, when we go around and tell people that we're doing this project, the Witness to Guantanamo Project, many times even, quote, informed citizens will say to us, but Guantanamo is closed. Americans have basically closed their eyes to what's going on in Guantanamo and let it go. And meanwhile, the rest of the world is watching. A lot of people feel that not only is it a stain on America, but in fact the world sees it as to point to and say America doesn't believe in human rights, America doesn't believe in the rule of law, and they keep pointing to Guantanamo. The world is much more conscious of what Guantanamo is than we are in America, and I think it's really important for Americans to understand that.
David Glazer.
I agree. I mean, fortunately, it seems to me that the reaction so far has been largely to be critical of the United States, but certainly there is an equal risk that other countries start doing similar things and pointing to the United States as justification. Certainly, it's predictable that our democratic friends around the world aren't going to do that. They're going to remain critics. But certainly, there are plenty of undemocratic countries around the world who, when the opportunity presents itself to treat people in a similar fashion, will cite with approval what the United States has done and use that as justification to engage in similar treatment towards other people.
Given all of this, the history, the loss of trust from other countries, given the obstacles that we've seen, how do you see this issue resolving, Jonathan Hafetz?
You know, hopefully it will resolve in the right way and the prison will be closed and that, you know, detainees who are not charged will be released. You know, that's what I think should happen. I'm not optimistic that it's going to happen anytime soon. The one encouraging sign has been the attention to be focused on Guantanamo, you know, as a result of the hunger strike. I think that the prisoners themselves who have really put the microscope back on Guantanamo, significant uptick in media attention. You saw the fruits of that when the president was forced to say the United States was going to re-energize its efforts to close the prison. The key will be to see what the Obama administration does next, whether it really takes action that it has under existing law to transfer detainees, the detainees who have been cleared for release from Guantanamo, and whether it will resist in the next round of appropriations any efforts to block its power to bring detainees to the United States for trial, or if there's some that's going to continue to hold for some period of time. And the proof will be in the pudding about whether the Obama administration really takes the decisive steps that it needs to take in order to close the prison and to meet its commitment to restore the rule of law.
So if you were advising the Obama administration, what would you say?
If I were advising the Obama administration, I would say that the administration should use all the authority it has to transfer detainees. It has authority still, notwithstanding the congressional restrictions. It's a disgrace, and there's no basis of holding individuals who the administration has said don't pose a threat to national security, to hold them year after year. And then second, it needs to fight and use the veto if necessary to prevent Congress from restricting the president's power to try people in federal courts. I think the military commission should be shut down. They may be shut down by the courts effectively in the end, but I think it's up to the Obama administration to say, look, this is not the way to handle terrorism trials, and we need to try people in federal courts. And so it should fight any further restrictions against the president's ability to do that.
Peter?
First of all, I think your listeners need to understand that when Obama points at the Congress and says Congress restricts him, that's a little bit disingenuous because he signed the legislation every time that Congress passes it, he signed it. So he's part of that process. And what I would tell Obama is to have some courage and do the right thing. I mean, he has a legacy, and he doesn't seem to think that this is part of his legacy. He's going to take a legacy with him that he didn't close down. He didn't do what he said he would do. Don't say something if you don't mean it. He obviously is not going to close down Guantanamo. Everyone we interview seems to believe that it's not going to happen. He does not have the courage. He will not do the right thing. I'm afraid, I hope Jonathan is right, but I'm afraid it won't be until the next administration, if that, when Guantanamo will perhaps close. I just don't think Obama has the courage to do what he needs to do.
David Glazer.
I guess I fall somewhere in between the two. I agree with Jonathan that he ought to do the right thing. He's a second-term president. A second-term president can't be reelected, so he ought to display the leadership to get us in conformance with the law now and not leave that for 2016, because if a Republican wins, then we'll go 4 more years without making any progress. If a Democrat wins, they're going to be under a lot of pressure if they do this. So the right time to do it is now, when we have a lame duck president who's already on record as saying it needs to be done. So he just needs to develop the courage to follow through.
Thank you to the three of you for joining us, Peter Honigsberg, David Glazer, and Jonathan Hafetz. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
David Glazer is a fellow and professor of law at Loyola Law School. He's the author of numerous publications, including A Self-Inflicted Wound, A Half Dozen Years of Turmoil Over the Guantanamo Military Commissions, and Full and Fair by What Measure, International Law Applicable to the Military Commission Process. Jonathan Hafetz is professor of law at Seton Hall. He is the author of Habeas Corpus After 9/11, Confronting America's New Global Detention System, and the co-editor with Mark Denbo of The Guantanamo Lawyers, Inside a Prison, Outside the Law. Peter Jan Honigsberg is professor of law at University of San Francisco School of Law. He's the founder and director of the Witness to Guantanamo Project. He's also the author of numerous publications, including the book Our Nation Unhinged, The Human Consequences of the War on Terror, and law publications, Chasing Enemy Combatants and Circumventing International Law, A License for Sanctioned Abuse. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chiprinankine Agassian and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes, and follow us on Twitter at @armudian. I possess some say I'm fresh with my voice on.